Addiction. It's a word that carries, well, a lot of weight, doesn't it? We tend to jump to ideas of personal failure, maybe weak will.
Mm-hmm.
But what if? What if that whole framing is missing something, something fundamental?
Mm-hmm.
What if addiction isn't really the root problem, but maybe more like a symptom, a sign of deeper needs not being met?
That changes the whole conversation, doesn't it? And that's exactly the angle we're exploring in this deep dive.
We're digging into Chapter 12 of Unraveling the Fabric of Fear, which is called Psychological Addiction as a Symptom. And, you know, in our previous deep dives, we've sort of laid some groundwork.
We have.
We looked at self-worth and social value. That was topic 4. And then trust and respect in relationships back in topic 8. It all kind of connects. So our mission today is to really unpack the argument this chapter makes. The idea that addiction, maybe it's less about some kind of inherent flaw and much more about, well, fundamental human needs. Things like social value, acceptance, connection.
Or crucially, the lack of those things.
Right. And this chapter, it definitely builds on things we've touched on before from the book, you know, fear, connection, conditioning, how they all sort of weave together.
And the core idea, the really central point the source puts forward, is addiction as a symptom. It's closely related to connection, they say, but the outcomes are basically polar opposites. The chapter uses the Merriam-Webster definition for addiction, a compulsion to do something despite negative consequences.
Despite negative consequences. That phrase feels really important.
It is. It highlights that chronic, harmful nature, you know?
Yeah.
The compulsion overriding the obvious downsides.
Okay, let's break this down a bit. So if addiction is this compulsion you keep doing even when it hurts you, the source suggests its opposite isn't just like stopping.
No, it's actually self-control.
Self-control.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you mentioned connection. Its opposite is disconnection.
Mm-hmm.
That frames it differently straight away, doesn't it? It's not just about the action. It's about control, about relationship.
That's a really important distinction.
It is because, and this is crucial, the chapter explains that feeding an addiction can actually trigger really similar reward chemistry in our brain. The same pathways light up as when we feel valued and accepted by others.
Oh, okay. That's where it gets really interesting. So when we find ourselves, I don't know, reaching for that drink or just scrolling endlessly on social media or whatever the addictive behavior is,
mm-hmm.
Our brain can get a similar dopamine rush, you know, that feel-good chemical, as it does from genuine social acceptance.
Pretty much, yeah. And what's fascinating, or maybe a bit scary, is that this similarity can, well, at least for a bit, fool our brains. It tricks us into thinking that our deep need for social connection is actually being met.
Like a shortcut, a brain hack.
Sort of, yeah. That immediate hit of pleasure from the addiction can temporarily quiet down that fundamental human longing for belonging.
The source actually calls this mechanism acceptance substitution.
Acceptance substitution. Using the addiction as a stand-in for that vital social validation. Because our self-worth, it really relies heavily on social value, on acceptance, doesn't it? Which in turn depends on actual connection.
Right. And as we've seen in previous deep dives, feeling socially accepted gives a significant dopamine boost in the brain. It's a really powerful reward signal.
So when that's missing, when we feel that lack of social value or belonging,
that's when we become more vulnerable. We're much more likely to seek out other ways anyway, really, to stimulate those same reward centers.
Which explains why, according to the source, we can get psychologically addicted to practically anything that gives that temporary boost, that lift to our sense of self-worth, or just delivers that specific reward feeling.
Even if it's just a chemical imitation of the real social reward.
Yeah.
And the list of examples they give is broad.
Incredibly broad. It's not just the obvious things like drugs or alcohol. It mentions excessive shopping, intense focus on fitness or beauty, constantly checking investments.
Things people might not even label as addiction sometimes.
Right. Social media scrolling, video games.
Sex, porn, gambling, hoarding.
The list goes on.
It does. The chapter even jokes that, you know, maybe writing the book itself could qualify. Anything that offers that internal reward when the necessary external social reward, that genuine acceptance and connection, feels missing or just too hard to get.
Also things like overeating, sleeping too much, seeking power, even hobbies taken to an extreme, gardening, writing, if it's filling that reward gap compulsively.
So the behavior itself becomes a kind of temporary acceptance substitution. That's the phrase they use, right?
That phrase really captures it, doesn't it? Acceptance substitution. The behavior, or the substance, is acting as a stand-in, mimicking that feeling that ideally should come from authentic connection and a solid sense of self-worth.
But like any substitute, it's not the real thing. And it comes with costs.
Oh, absolutely. Significant costs. The chapter highlights a few. There's often a financial cost that's pretty obvious for many addictions.
Yeah.
And then there are the labels. We talked about this in previous deep dives, how labels can impact people. This chapter brings it up again, how being labeled an addict can really limit a person's perceived potential. It ties back to those ideas about conditioning and potential we explored.
Right, the social consequences. But the chapter argues the most critical cost goes back to connection, or rather, the lack of it, disconnection.
Yes, this is the crucial part of the mechanism they propose. Because feeding the addiction activates those reward pathways that feel like social acceptance, it actually temporarily reduces your perceived need for the real thing, for genuine social connection.
Wait, so the addiction itself makes you feel less like you need other people, less lonely, maybe.
That seems to be the idea. It's providing a kind of simulation of that social reward. And this, according to the chapter, leads straight into what it calls a vicious spiral.
Because the act of engaging in the addiction triggers reward chemistry that feels a bit like social acceptance, it lowers our subjective need for real social connection right then and there. But by neglecting real relationships, by withdrawing from actual connections, our underlying fundamental need to activate those reward centers via the addiction actually gets stronger.
So it drives us further into the cycle.
Exactly. Increasing our disconnection and therefore making us rely even more on the addiction.
It's a feedback loop from hell, isn't it? The thing you use for a temporary fix makes you pull away from people. But pulling away from people makes the need for that fix even stronger.
Precisely. And you can just imagine how devastating this cycle is. Think about, say, parents caught in this loop. Their withdrawal because of the addiction just ripples outwards. How might this affect their relationships with their kids, who are probably the ones most desperate for that very connection the parent is struggling to find elsewhere? That's heavy. Thinking about the impact on families, how these patterns might even get passed down.
It's a very sobering thought. Which brings us to an interesting wrinkle the source mentions about connection itself. While it's kind of positioned as the antidote, genuine connection isn't always easy or comfortable, is it?
No, it's not. There's a sort of cost to connection, to not financial, but interpersonal.
What do you mean?
Well, any meaningful social connection involves navigating feedback, right?
Yeah.
You get criticism sometimes, praise other times. You're bound to have moments where your life conditioning, your way of seeing things, bumps up against someone else's.
Ah, okay. So the quality of those interactions, how we handle that feedback, both giving and receiving it, that becomes really critical.
Hugely important. The source reminds us, and this echoes earlier chapters, that constructive feedback, when it's delivered with respect and real support, actively builds things like self-belief, confidence, trust, respect.
All those crucial qualities.
Yeah, perseverance, adaptability, curiosity, creativity, things we need to thrive. So constructive feedback isn't just about being nice. The source argues it's actively protective. It reduces vulnerability to addiction.
Okay, so connection is vital, but the quality matters immensely, shaped by how we handle feedback. This vulnerability also ties back to conditioning, which the source revisits here, calling it associative addiction.
Mm-hmm. This really highlights the power of classical conditioning. You know, Pavlov's dogs.
Right.
The source points out how we can become conditioned to associate totally non-addictive things, items, places, sounds, with our addictive behaviors.
Like seeing an empty bottle or a specific place.
Or even just the notification sound on your phone. These things can become powerful cues, triggering really intense cravings. It's why people might talk about bottle addiction or smartphone addiction. The object itself isn't the drug, obviously, but the association built up over time is incredibly strong.
That mechanism really shows how deep conditioning can go. And the source emphasizes that we're vulnerable to this kind of classical conditioning our entire lives.
And here's the critical link the chapter makes to rehabilitation. If we are conditionable across our whole lifespan, especially through our brain's reward centers, which respond so strongly to social stuff, then it stands to reason that it is always possible to recondition people, to rehabilitate them, specifically using the power of social reward. Positive reconditioning is possible at any age.
That feels like a really powerful message of hope. That change, healing, it's always on the table.
It is. But then the source immediately highlights a major clash with how society often approaches addiction and, well, justice.
How so?
Because enforcing reduced social connection, which often happens in justice systems, or just when someone is shunned because of their addiction, that actually increases stress levels.
Right. Makes sense.
And increased stress, as the source reminds us, makes people more vulnerable to addictive behaviors. It strips away vital emotional support networks. Networks that are crucial not just for crisis moments, but are even linked to living longer and better overall health, which came up in the chapter on justice too.
So the very systems often set up to correct behavior, operating through disconnection, punishment, labeling, might actually be working against the most effective path to rehabilitation the source points to.
Which is fostering genuine social connection, acceptance, and constructive support for healing.
It's a huge paradox the source lays bare. The very medicine proposed is often denied to the people who need it most.
Yeah, it really is.
Okay. Yeah.
And just to add, there's neurological evidence cited that backs up the core idea of shared pathways. For example, brain scans of people diagnosed with smartphone addiction.
Smartphone addiction, like clinical diagnosis?
Yes. Those scans show patterns that are remarkably similar to scans of people with diagnosed substance use disorders.
Similar brain activity. Wow.
Yeah, things like increased activity in the brain areas that process salience, meaning how much something grabs your attention, how important it feels.
Like a phone or the drug becomes the most important thing.
Exactly. And at the same time, decreased activity in the areas responsible for executive function planning, impulse control, decision making, willpower. Is a striking parallel, suggesting a common underlying neurological mechanism is at play.
Okay, that's a lot to take in. We've got the definition addiction as this acceptance substitution, the spiral of disconnection, the critical role of feedback, conditioning, reconditioning, the problems with enforced isolation.
And even echoes in ancient wisdom.
Right, almost forgot that. The chapter briefly touches on how different religious traditions viewed something similar, didn't it? Long before brain scans.
It did. It suggests these patterns aren't new human struggles. For instance, it mentions Christianity and the idea of original sin may be interpreted as a kind of fundamental disconnection from the divine, creating a void that people try to fill externally.
And Islam.
It points to the concept of nafs, the self, the ego with its desires. Unchecked, this could lead someone towards addictive behaviors as a way of coping, maybe unhealthily, with internal states or desires.
Buddhism too, right, with craving.
Yes, linking addiction, called tana or craving, directly to dukkha, suffering or dissatisfaction. The idea is that craving stems from this sense of disconnection or feeling that something essential is missing inside.
And Hinduism
talks about disconnection from the true self, influenced by the gunas, these qualities of nature shaping our mind. It might frame addiction as a kind of disease of the mind, driven by desires and fears, seeking external fixes due to that internal disconnection.
It's really striking, isn't it, how these very different traditions, using their own language, all seem to point towards some kind of internal lack, disconnection, or struggle as being fundamental to what we now call addiction.
It definitely suggests the core human vulnerability here is something ancient and widely recognized, even if explained differently.
Thinking about how deeply conditioning affects us right through life and how vital that genuine social connection seems to be both for preventing addiction and for enabling recovery, it leaves us with a pretty big question, doesn't it?
Well, consider what that implies. What if societies could genuinely shift their approach to addiction?
And maybe even justice systems.
Moving away from models often based on punishment and disconnection.
What responsibility do we have as a society to actually build environments that build real self-worth?
And towards actively fostering real social connection, acceptance, and truly constructive support for healing and growth.
Environments that might reduce the need for people to seek out unhealthy substitutions in the first place.
That's certainly something to mull over. A profound question about prevention and creating healthier social fabrics.
Indeed. Maybe think about the systems and interactions you encounter in your own life, your community, your workplace, even your family. How do they currently lean towards connection or disconnection?
And how might they be intentionally shifted, maybe even in small ways, to better support healing and growth instead?
Food for thought, indeed. It definitely challenges some conventional thinking.
It really does.
Stay connected, stay curious and forgiving. With your permission, we'll see you next time.